News from the Bunker is brought to you by Tucker Survival.
You're just going to know where it did.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you do. There's a lot of people that are going to die.
Yeah.
Period. That's just the way it's going to be. It's cited here. It took special trains to carry away the dead. In fact, in one of the city summaries, it talked about spouses having to keep their own spouses in bed after they died for up to like 6 days.
Wow.
Because there was literally no place to take the bodies to process them. That's how many people were dying. I mean, this is radical. There were people breaking ribs from coughing because the coughing was so violent. They were bleeding at times, although this was less common, from the eyes and the ears from this flu. There were enough anecdotal reports from reliable observers that proved some deaths were extraordinarily rapid, occurring in 24 hours or less. And so basically it's from 24 hours to 6 days was the mortality rate with this thing for a lot of people. And this is interesting to your viewers. This would be interesting to know. So it has a context paragraph in this report. And remember, this is at the end of World War I. So World War I, I think, ended in November or of 11th, I think. So context, we were at war. It was the first total war. It was the first time the government tried to fully control the public. So there was a lot of government control during this flu before the flu hit. That was already in place. The pandemic was known as Spanish flu, but we know it did not start in Spain. It was called Spanish flu because Spain was not at war, so there was a free press there. Most of Europe had a censored press. The U.S. press was more open, but still, the new Sedition Act was passed. Now, this is what your viewers will take to heart as very interesting. This was a law that made the Patriot Act look like it was written by the ACLU. So this was highly restricted, the Sedition Act, in World War I. And there was a lot of government control then.
Yeah.
Okay. But anyway, this was a bad Jose, man. This is a bad Jose. They talked about there was a lot of propaganda then, and a lot of this was tied into the war. And one of the things that was interesting that I didn't realize before I got into this, during this time, at least 25% of the doctors and nurses were in the military. Now, that is political, because when you start having the government control everything and a quarter of your medical community is part of the military, it does matter. And I don't know to what extent that all went through the whole thing, but they did cite that.
It's kind of interesting to see how some things are just the same.
That a lot
even
of things.
Even though 100 years has gone by, it's like the same type of mindsets, the same type of things going on.
And it's awful to say, but sometimes I just start laughing because of the similarities. Like, it's terrible that so many people died.
If you were to
died.
Read that, people would be like, yeah, that's what's going on today.
Actually,
this was back in 1918.
I can't believe the arguing about the mask. Should we social distance? Should we not? Should we close the school? Should we not? How long this should be open? And by the way, there was a lot of illogical closing, irrational closing. The saloons would stay open, but the parks would close.
Like now.
Right.
They were trying to keep the bar or the liquor stores open.
Well, and there was a thought, too, and this goes into human psychology, that they didn't want to shut down. And I would say not all cities were this way. But some cities were very reluctant. In fact, they didn't totally shut down the amusement because they were worried about the psychological blowback from the public if they didn't have an outlet for getting rid of their stress. And so that's something you got to be really careful about, is there's an immune response to not being able to socialize, not being able to go to a ballpark, not being able to go see some live music. And when you start playing with those things, you start interfering with people's immune responses. And also they're just mental stability. And now we're seeing this huge spike in suicides. We're seeing spikes in family violence because these things that kept people kind of blowing off steam have been removed.
Well, like the whole entertainment industry is really suffering.
Right.
Like there's a movement now called the SOS to save all the stages, the venues, because they're not making any money, even starting to make movies again. A lot of the studios, they would start and then they're locked down again. And it's like, how do you make a movie social distancing?
Right, yeah.
And you're in there and people are close and they're holding lights and mics and you got actors that are interacting. And it's like,
well,
you're seeing an entire industry that could be wiped out you know, by shutting down like
this. I have the LA report. We might have to pull it out because in LA they kept shooting. But they had a moratorium or a restriction on certain types of scenes they could shoot. And so they weren't allowed to shoot any mob scenes. Because remember, this is in World War One era when all the mobster movies were coming out in Chicago and, you know, this kind of stuff. So they couldn't shoot any mob scene movies during the flu pandemic. And then there was something else. There was like two big restrictions they had. But they kept shooting. Yeah. But that was just in Hollywood. I don't know outside of Hollywood how that factored in.
Like New York and stuff on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, they talk a lot about the importance of communication. And this is something interesting that there in Phoenix, a rumor started that dogs carried influenza and people started shooting their pets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And here's the one about the spouse's
dog. They were doing that in China. They were wanting people to bring their dogs out and were wanting to euthanize them.
Yeah.
So that was a thing. It's the same thing.
You get in a panic state.
Yeah.
You start making irrational decisions.
People are having to bring their pets out and have them destroyed. And it's horrible.
So this paragraph states, there was a lot of cognitive dissonance. People heard from authorities and newspapers that everything was going fine, but at the same time, bodies were piling up. Imagine your spouse lying in bed for 6 to 8 days. There were coffin shortages. The dead were piled up where they died. There were police going around asking people to literally bring out their dead. And so, yes, I agree. Today's flu is not the same. If we're just looking at what happened. And thank God. I mean, this is pretty radical, right? Takeaway message at the end of this part of the report. Quote, false assurance is the worst thing you can do. Don't withhold information because people will think you know more. Tell the truth. Don't manage the truth. If you don't know something, say why you don't know and say what you need to do to know. Drown people with the truth rather than withhold it. And that's why I'm here. Because I was talking to my documentary filmmaker just today and he goes, Ron, you need to be in front of people talking about this. He goes, no one is talking about this. I'm like, why aren't people talking about this?
Well, it's like Dr. Fauci coming out telling us, you know, we don't need to wear the mask. Well, then he comes out, you know, recently, a few weeks back, and said basically he said that because he was trying to protect the mask supply.
Yeah.
You know, well, you lied to everybody. Yeah. You could have just came out and said that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in that position, you can't be doing that. You know, you need to be truthful with people. Yeah. Now people aren't going to trust you.
One thing that came out, and this, and again, I'm trying to read into this without any confirmational bias and just trying to keep an open mind, but the politicians that cited in the reports, they want to keep the same storyline going, right?
Yeah.
The medical community, they roll with the data. That's what's supposed to happen. If they see different results and different data and things are happening, they might need to change, and they should change midstream and reverse a decision or take a different route. And so that made me back off a little bit and say, you know, I need to give these people space but I also need to trust them that they are using the right data without the political attachments. And I think this is me personally talking now. I think that's what's happened in 2020 is we become very distrustful of people because of all the politics involved and the money part of it. So here's a few more factoids here from this conference about the 1918 flu that I think people need to know. At that time, it was equivalent of 9/11 happening every day. Now, if you live through 9/11, think about that. That's how bad this was. For example, assassination attempts against Lenin were on page 12. Right? Ahead of this story, the Tsar had been executed, right? 1918 case fatality rates in 1 to 4 year old children is equivalent to what it would take now for 15 to 16 years of fatalities. So to get that same amount of death in 1918, today, at the time of this, 2006, it would take 15 plus years to get the same amount of deaths as we saw in just one, you know, year in 1918. That's how deadly this was for young children. In fact, I just learned that a lot of the pandemics have a U-shaped curve. It's not the bell curve that goes this way. It's actually like the letter U. This one had a W-shaped curve. And the W in the middle was a 20 to 40-year-old a spike of deaths. And so a lot of people that were very healthy, we can say in the prime of life, were just dying. It wasn't just the really young, and it wasn't just the really old and the feeble. It was also the people in the middle. So I thought that was interesting. To put this in perspective, the median time between onset and time of death was 8 to 10 days.
Wow.
So, you know, that's pretty intense.
Now, were there people that had very mild bouts of this?
You know, I was reading, because there's a section in here in literature, and very few people actually wrote about it that were authors. Fitzgerald, I think it was Fitzgerald, or I can't remember who the author was. He had a mild case, and his position on it was he was upset because it delayed his trip to Europe.
But the majority of it was pretty extreme then from what you
said. Yeah, we know a lot of people got infected, and and not as many people died that got infected. And I can pull up some of that because I have those summarized in the front of the reports. I'll get into that in a minute.
Now, were they actively trying to find like a vaccine in those days?
There was. In fact, in Seattle, where they build a lot of ships, they inoculated about 100% of the ship workers. And they did like a double inoculation with a lot of them. And they said, oh, this is keeping them from getting sick. And then it was cited, didn't do anything. But in Salt Lake City, they actually had a flu vaccination public campaign. And there were thousands of people that lined up for it. So, yes, they did have a vaccination. It didn't seem to do much. I mean, I think the vaccinations today are much more effective than the vaccinations 100 years ago, from what I know. Vaccinations are not my specialty area and cup of tea, so that's a whole nother thing that I probably shouldn't get into. But to answer your question, yeah, they were doing it then. They were doing it. So logic suggests that social distancing measures helped, but I am not convinced that those interventions had an effect that was anything more than random. And this is one of the experts at the workshop speaking about this. Some tentative evidence shows that social distancing interventions did help, another expert cited before he spoke. So it's like, you know, there's some gray area there, which actually kind of surprised me. One of the issues with the transmission of the flu in 1918 was because we were at war, there were a lot of major military bases close to the big cities, and there was a constant flow of people in and out because of the military. In fact, Camp Dodge is outside of Des Moines, Iowa, and that was a really hot spot because they were still building Camp Dodge. And so you had civilians going in and out doing the construction work in the middle of all this. And this is where the government control part gets really interesting, because we had to win the war, there was a lot of things in an override state, like we just had to do it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, damn the torpedoes type of thing. And then in other cases, they did yank back and they did quarantine the bases, but it wasn't always the case that the military got to override everything, but there was some of that going on because of the severity of the situation. Of course, and then when we won the war, everybody went out in the street and they partied like crazy. But by then, it was mostly over because, you know, that was November 11th. So,
and this was truly a worldwide pandemic.
Yeah, you know, it was in Europe. Well, it actually is supposed to have started in Kansas.
Yeah.
But it was a bigger deal in Europe earlier in the year. And from what I've read, it got bad here in the United States in the very end of August, early September, or as late as early October. And by then, I'd say by October, most of the cities were in it at some level, you know. But it's cited here, it is important to understand how quickly the pandemic moved in military camps, 2.5 weeks. So that's like in and out, peak period. And in the civilian community, it was more like 5 to 6 weeks. And so the peak was a matter of days or citing. So if you combine all that together, we've got a 2 to 6 week hot zone, danger zone for this flu that was called a hit and run disease to move in, blast through the herd, if you will, and then move on out. Yeah. And of course, there was some tapering and there was a little bit of buildup, but I like to simplify things And so my big walkaway takeaway from going through hundreds of pages of data now is that it was about a 2 to 6 week danger zone. Now we went, our schools in California, where I was teaching, we went home in March.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about the kids not going back to school at least full time until next year.
Yeah.
Well, we could be looking at a whole year here. I'll be honest with all your listeners. I haven't seen one single school anywhere in the country from this information that I went through that stayed shut down for a full semester, let alone two, and let alone over the summer as well. Yeah. Now, I know it's a different flu, and I know it's a different time, but I'm just reporting the information. I'm reporting the facts. This is well-documented. It's well-researched. The schools were not shut down that long.
Yeah.
They just weren't. And maybe this is a completely different kind of flu, and it's a long, ongoing flu, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's going to hang on a year or two or three. I don't know. I'm not a physician and an epidemiologist. But I can tell you as a history researcher in health science that this is what happened. It is what it is, and we can at least talk about it. It rolled across the country and around the world in 8 days to 3 weeks. There were three waves in 1918, too, which I didn't realize until I got into this. I've heard about two waves, but there were actually three. The first wave was widely missed because symptoms were mild with little complications, four deaths. The second wave came 6 months after the first wave was noticed, and it was lethal. It rolled across the country and the world in around 8 days to 3 weeks. That was the second wave. So even then, without airplane flight,
yeah. It
moved pretty quickly. So at some point, it's like you kind of have to ask, like, is there anything we can do, really? I mean, even then, it just blew through the population. The velocity of the 1918 pandemic did not compare to those in 1957 and 1968. The 1918 pandemic moved much faster through communities. It's important to understand that all pandemics are different. In 1918, cities that were comparatively successful in mitigating the first wave were pressured to relax interventions. When relaxed, cities experienced that it never really went away. So this is something that I highlighted for me. Mm-hmm. When you relaxed, it never really went away. So I think, based on what I've learned so far, we should have been way more aggressive at the beginning, and we should have gotten this history information out and said, people, this is what really happened, and I know we've never seen anything like this before, but get ready because we're going there.
Well, this was like the textbook.
It's all there. And it's like throwing away the textbook. Somebody just sent me a report from a school, I think it was Minnesota. The principal went in and they threw away all the textbooks in the library, all the books in the library that were over 10 years old.
Ah.
Because she said they're outdated and they don't serve the culture. It's like, I mean, come on, you know? I mean, that's very, very dangerous, right?
Yes.
You have to be very careful about throwing away history that's over 10 years old.
Like when 2008, when we had the big recession, the first thing I did, I studied the Great Depression.
Yes.
It's like, who made money in the Great Depression? Well, there was all kinds of people that did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them were just problem solvers, you know? They saw opportunities. They didn't always have a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, I've spoken to people from the Great Depression and learned from them,
mm-hmm.
how they dealt with things. And here we have this example from 100 years ago that we could have delved into it. And, okay, let's see what they did, you know, to deal with their pandemic.
Interestingly, and it's at the end of, I think it's this report, that there was no depression that came out of this flu, and there was no major recession. It was like a little bump in the economy, and we rolled right through it. Because remember, it's like 2 to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
We were in and we were out. And then we had this massive period of economic gain until the Great Depression, the stock market crash in 29. So we had like a 10-year growth period coming out of this. Now, part of that, I'm sure, was the war, and there was a lot of different factors. But the thing of it was, the flu itself did not crash the economy.
Yeah.
And the economy wasn't totally shut down for months and months and months and months on end across the country. It was weeks. And as it was cited here, it was days.
And that's what's frustrating,
you know?
Is we're not seeing what this was. You know, I mean, people are getting sick, but most people are getting mild symptoms or not even know they're sick.
Yeah.
And yet we're shutting down the entire economy of the planet. And man, once those jobs are gone, those businesses are gone, we watched our food supply chain just crumble because mm-hmm. all the restaurants were closed. And yeah. the people don't understand distribution. Well, why can't they sell those eggs to the stores?
Right.
Well, that's a different set of buyers.
Yeah.
You know?
And it wasn't the case in these days because people were, it's cited here in the research, that people were much more self-sufficient
yeah.
in 1918. And also, San Francisco didn't rely as much on Los Angeles, who didn't rely as much on Phoenix. And so now everything's so integrated. Now, the advantage of that is we have more protection over one system going down because we're all connected and we can backfill. But the disadvantage of that is now you're dependent on so many other things feeding in. And so that was something that I learned out of all this. And people did have gardens in those days.
Yep.
And chickens and things like that, and that factored into the Depression quite heavily too. But it was interesting because they talked about the economy here, and I was thinking that I would find a much more significant effect in the economy, and that wasn't the case. And again, they're talking here at the end about the school services being so much better for the children from the medical standpoint. This is something interesting. If you get into civics, in these days, civic or government courses were taught in the high school curricula. And so at the time, you know, civic duty, civic responsibilities were inculcated. That's a kind of an old term that people don't use today, but it was basically like you're really taught over and over and over that this is the way you need to behave and this is a proper decorum in certain social situations. And we don't do that anymore. So the idea, you know, in the context of 1918, there was more civic education. We were at a war. There was more unity in terms of the country coming together. So
yeah.
when this medical emergency happened, I think people were more apt to work together as a team.
Yeah.
We see a lot of division today because we've lost so much of our sense of teamwork. It's just devastating, you know.
Well, I think the family units were much stronger. And
yes.
the families worked with other families. A lot of farming in America. So that whole idea of coming together and sharing resources was just a part of the fabric of America.
And so for the people that have criticized me like earlier today, well...